The signs of spring have arrived. Wild temperature swings, some plants are starting to bud, and thunderstorms dominate the sky. Even in the core of Kansas City, you can find animals and insects becoming more active. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we take a look at nature in and around Kansas City. We'll be exploring the spring behaviors of frogs, and then we'll soar into the trees and find out how birds of prey like the peregrine falcon and the bald eagle are faring. Finally, we'll take a stroll through some of the area's best places to observe nature doing its thing. It's Nature in the City, Spring Edition, and it starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and as I walked into the KCUR headquarters this morning, dare I say it felt like spring. So we couldn't have timed our spring installment of Nature in the City any better. Here to tell us everything we want to know about this year's spring are Joe Werner and Larry Rizzo, both regular contributors to Nature in the City. Joe is a biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry is a natural history biologist for the Missouri Department of Conservation. Good morning, guys. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Gina.
Can we start with frogs today? Because we have some audio of frog sounds that I am dying to play for our listeners.
How appropriate.
So the frogs are out making noises right now. Is that correct?
Oh, yes.
During the winter, when we're not hearing from these guys, where are they? What are they doing?
They're underground. And, of course, they're cold-blooded, so they can't be active during the wintertime. But some of them, for a cold-blooded creature, can be active during some surprisingly cold weather in late winter, early spring, sometimes even with patches of snow on the ground. So they're a really good early indicator of spring.
How healthy is our amphibian population in general? I've heard that the health of the amphibian population is a pretty good indicator of a region's environmental well-being in general.
That's a good statement. The amphibian populations in many parts of the country and the world are in real trouble, and it's because amphibians are very good barometers because they're semi-aquatic most of the time and also terrestrial animals. They live on land and the water, so water quality, air quality, habitat, all kinds of factors go into their population. So they are pretty good measuring stick of environmental quality. Here in Missouri, most of our species in the state are actually fairly healthy. We have certain issues with particular species, but by and large, most of our populations are pretty good.
Well, the first clip that we're going to be hearing is the sound of a western chorus frog. Tell us about this frog before we listen to the clip.
Well, this is one of the earliest frogs to come out in the spring, Gina, and it has a very, very distinctive call. I think most people that have spent any time out in the early spring, especially around a creek or a pond, have probably heard it. It sounds kind of like someone running their finger down a comb.
Oh,
let's,
goody.
Let's see what we've got.
I can't wait. That is an unbelievable sound. I really can't believe that an animal makes that. Can you tell us more about this frog that makes this sound?
Well, just imagine if there's more than one, which is typically the case. We were just hearing one right there, which is a good way just to learn the call. But quite often you'll hear dozens of them out there, and it is almost deafening.
For an animal, you have to keep in mind these little frogs are an inch and a half long. The volume they can produce is really pretty incredible. And, of course, these are the male frogs, just like most all birds. It's the males that do the singing. It's the same way with amphibians and for the same reasons.
Where would our listeners go to encounter the western chorus frogs up close?
They are more open country kind of a frog, so grasslands, roadside ditches. This time of year, like these big rains we've got, if you get some roadside ditches with it, they're starting to hold water, that's perfect for them. They like those places because they're not going to contain predators that would eat their eggs or the tadpoles because they're ephemeral little pools of water.
Yeah. fishless ponds are just a wonderful place for them.
So let's just say, for hypothetically, that we have some amateur nature sound recording enthusiasts out there. Any tips on getting up close to these creatures and hearing their sounds without scaring them off?
A lot of patience.
Yeah, that's a good one, because it's actually very fun to try to get close to a group of them calling, because they will sense your presence when you're generally 20, 30 feet away and just shut up very quickly. And it's I've always kind of wondered how they're able to do that.
So next up, we're going to listen to the spring peeper, which actually sounds like a bird or perhaps a marshmallow-based Easter candy, but it too is a frog. Tell us about the spring peeper.
Well, peepers, again, they're very similar to the same things we've said about chorus frogs. So their habitat is a little different. They're more of a forest or woodland kind of a creature. And we're about the northern extent of their range here in Kansas City. If you go south of here, in the south part of the metro area, you're more apt to hear them than north. And very characteristic sound you're going to hear down in the Ozarks right now.
Let's listen to the spring peeper's call. So that's the spring peeper. Tell us more about why this call is significant.
Well, they're trying to track mates. That's why birds sing, that's and that's why
game.
Frogs call. So they're grouping around these ponds, and I guess if you know the more of them, the more males are calling around a pond, the greater that sound is going to carry, and the more females are going to track. So it's sort of a group effort, you might say.
They sound almost electronic.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I have stood next to ponds where peepers called, and it will hurt your ears.
Yeah, it gets very, very loud.
Tell me, is there any other amphibian out there that you think we should be talking about?
Well, if we're looking a little bit south of here from, say, Cass County south into the prairie region, the crayfish frog is very interesting. Again, it's got a very large call. It sounds like someone snoring.
Always a sound you're excited to hear.
or a bunch of hogs.
There you go.
And we have them fairly close to the metro area, out around the Lone Jack area. We've had some occurrences of that. That's a prairie creature, and that's one that it's relatively rare in Missouri due to the fact that we don't have that much prairie land left. Mm-hmm. It's a grassland prairie species.
What do frogs eat?
Depends on the frog, but... you know, the quick answer for something like a bullfrog is anything that moves that it can swallow.
Even other frogs.
Including other bullfrogs. you know, insects a lot, probably the largest single component of their diet.
I was just wondering if the winter that we've had, if you could quickly let me know, like, is this cold winter affecting insect populations and therefore frog food?
That's a very difficult question to answer, Gina. The, you know, the insects... Some of them, you know, they're very adaptable and make it through the winter very easily. You know, they've done it for eons.
And frogs aren't specialists, so it's not like they're dependent on one particular type of insect. So they're in pretty good shape there, I think.
It is so much fun to talk about frogs and listen to frog sounds, but we've got a chorus of our own to tend to now here in the KCUR studios. It's our spring pledge drive here at KCUR, and as you may know, our station relies on support from listeners like you. Sylvia Maria Gross is here to tell you how to contribute. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm here with Joe Werner and Larry Rizzo for Nature in the City. Joe is a biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry is a natural history biologist for the Missouri Department of Conservation. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Gina.
Good morning, Gina.
So we've just talked a little bit about frogs, and now we're going to discuss the birds. It's bird migration season. Who's coming through town, as it were?
Oh, Gina, this is such an exciting time of the year. There's just hundreds of birds that are coming through, thousands actually, and you know, most people are probably thinking that, you know, this is a good time to get out there, and this is one of the best times of the year to see the bird migration. So we would really encourage folks to get out and see what's going on.
Who's If you were wanting to attract some of the birds passing through our area right now to your windowsill, what kinds of stuff would you be putting in your feeder?
Well, a lot of the birds that are really visible right now and interesting are not feeder birds at the moment. But people can get out and see things like white pelicans right now are coming through, which are, well, it's actually the largest bird in Missouri, weight and I believe wingspan-wise. Yeah. Waterfowl, the turkey vultures have just returned in numbers here in recent couple of weeks.
Tell me more about turkey vultures. That sounds kind of scary.
Oh, they're quite gentle souls, really, that perform an important ecological function. But they migrate out in the winter. You can appreciate if you're a vulture and the diet you eat that frozen roadkill is not something that you could readily eat. So they can't really live around here too well in the winter. But as soon as things start to warm up, they're back.
So someone just did a bad PR job calling them a vulture?
Well, that's name goes back, a long way. But, I mean, I always like to say they may not look pretty and their eating habits may not be attractive sounding to us, but if you watch them fly, they're really a beautiful creature.
They are. They just glide along, rocking their wings in a V-shape, and they're really pretty. You know, another bird, Larry was talking about the water birds, that we don't see very often through here is the double-crested cormorant. And they are moving through here in large flocks right now. And if you're anywhere near a lake, and you see a dead snag of a tree, perhaps down by the bank of a lake, you'll often see the cormorant sitting up there.
What accounts for them passing through if they don't normally?
Well, they nest north of here and spend the winter down in the Gulf usually, you know, further south.
So they're passing through for a brief period. As far as feeder birds, though, one thing to keep in mind here, we're getting close to hummingbird season. Won't be starting to show up for at least another week, but before the month is out would be time to put out hummingbird feeders.
Mm-hmm. There's a particular bird I want to talk to you about from a conservation standpoint, the peregrine falcon. The Missouri Department of Conservation has made a concerted effort to rehabilitate that population and to do so right in downtown Kansas City. Could one of you give us the history on that?
Well, back in the early 1990s, the Missouri Conservation Department and Commerce Bank and some other local companies decided that restoring peregrine falcons in Kansas City would be a good experiment to try. And the reason that they tried that is because it has been successful, or had been successful in several other metropolitan cities, New York and Los Angeles, Minneapolis and all. And so some peregrine falcons were secured through the University of Minnesota and released in downtown Kansas City on Commerce Bank building.
That process of releasing them, what does that entail?
Well, actually, the Conservation Department had an individual that actually was on site and managed that particular release. And what it was they took these very young birds that could not fly and they put them in these hacking boxes on the top of Commerce Bank and fed them in a manner such that the birds did not associate people with feed. So when they did
in such a manner,
fly,
well, can you unpack that a little?
Yeah, the birds couldn't see the people that were being the ones that were feeding the birds. They were feeding them quail, as an example, some things that perhaps peregrines would eat out in the wild. And when they got old enough to fly, why, they opened the cage up, and the birds flew. And typically when a bird flies, it may come back to the area that it first fledged from or flew from and nest. And that's exactly what's happened. And Larry can tell us about the results here in the Kansas City area and throughout the Midwest.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that. It's been how many years?
Since about 91, 92.
And how has it progressed? How are we doing with the
falcon? Well, currently, quite well. We have five active nests in the region. Three of them are at KCP&L power plants up at Iatan and Platte County and the Sibley and Hawthorne plants on their towers. And the Commerce Bank building downtown and the American Century building on the plaza all have nesting, currently active nests right now. We also, last fall, and I got to be part of this, we installed a box on top of Arrowhead Stadium, up on top of the press box. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of waiting to see whether that has attracted any birds. And it may or may not this year, but hopefully in the coming years we'll get a pair out there. They seem to take to those boxes pretty readily.
And, you know, one of the reasons that it's so successful in the urban areas like this is because the predators on the young peregrines are not as abundant. And, you know, you would be talking about great horned owls as an example that would actually raid a peregrine falcon nest in the wild. They had tried to release them along the cliffs of the Mississippi River and found that, by they I mean the Fish and Wildlife Service directed this, and they found that great horned owls were just eating these young birds. And so in the urban area, you know, you don't often think of it as being an area where birds are protected, but that's one of the results.
And they are a cliff nesting type of bird, so tall buildings, it provides mm-hmm. the structure that's attractive to them. They don't care if it's a cliff or a building, but it's the same type of habitat, and they like wide open spaces and big views, so they like to be up high.
So what is the intersection for that building where this nest currently exists?
Which nest?
On the plaza?
The Commerce Building.
It's down near 9th and Main?
Yeah, 9th and Main, in between 8th and 9th and Main.
And the nest is on the north side of the building.
Yeah, it overlooks the Missouri River, the downtown airport, and, you know, that's where the birds end up hunting quite a bit.
So if there are people out there in and around downtown interested in kind of spotting these falcons, say they're not trained in bird watching, what are they looking for?
A fast-flying bird.
it will somewhat resemble a pigeon, not yeah, in the it way does. It flies, but yeah. the size and shape of
yeah.
them. So if you can picture that, but a very direct flight, very fast, you may see a bunch of pigeons scattering ahead of
that's a good hint. And they have what they call butcher sights. After they catch a bird, and they typically catch a bird on the wing, and they'll take it to a certain particular building, and that's what they call a butcher site where they feed.
Well, we will be right back with more about the peregrine falcon as well as news about the nesting bald eagle. But we're going to take a break now because local reporting on important issues like wildlife conservation requires funding. Welcome back, and I'm here with Joe Werner and Larry Rizzo. We're talking about nature in the city. We were just discussing the peregrine falcon and efforts to rehabilitate that population in downtown Kansas City. There's another bird that I want to talk about, another bird of prey, the bald eagle, and its nesting patterns. What's the history of the bald eagle in this area?
Well, Missouri historically has always had bald eagles, but the large numbers of eagles are a wintertime phenomenon. They come down here and spend the winter. We're just located at about the right part of the country, and we have lots of rivers and lakes, and the rivers in particular tend to stay open in the wintertime. Squaw Creek National Wildlife Refuge up by Mound City is one of the premier places to see wintering eagles. You can stand in one place and see 200 or 300 sometimes. But bald eagles, like peregrine falcons, suffered from DDT poisoning, and it affected their nesting and reproduction. And we went without nesting eagles in Missouri for quite some time. First one documented, I believe, was 1980.
1980 down at the Mingo National Wildlife Refuge.
And we've grown from there. And honestly, we don't have a firm count on them anymore. And that's a good thing because it means there are just mm-hmm. so darn many of them. We can't keep track of them anymore, but we are in the hundreds.
Talk about that distinction. Yeah. You've said nesting eagles. What is the difference between simply having an eagle that's in the area and having a nesting eagle in the area?
Yeah, it's important to distinguish. And nesting means they nest here and raise young. But another term that is used is roosting, and sometimes people use that interchangeably, and that's not the same thing. You know, roosting mm-hmm. is just a congregation of eagles that spends the night in a particular place maybe, or likes to hang out and loaf in a particular area where there's a lot of food or something like that. But nesting is where they build a nest and raise young.
And nesting eagles, actually the population of nesting eagles is doubling about every 5 years in the Midwest. So that's a very, very encouraging thing, Gina. And it's interesting because I've seen nests even along Front Street on the Missouri River in downtown Kansas City. Eagles will sometimes build, I suppose, what's called a false nest or an alternate nest. And it's one that, you know, perhaps young ones would build when they're just becoming mature, and not use, but perhaps move north and nest further north. Now, you know, the interesting thing about the eagles is there's a Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, a federal act that actually protects them and their nests on a year-round basis. So you can't even disturb a bald eagle nest, you know, when it's unoccupied, when it doesn't have eggs or young in it.
Would you want to? That sounds like
well,
a bad idea.
You know, some people, you know, may innocently will say, you know, cut a tree down that has an eagle nest in it. Well, they really need to think twice about doing that. And especially since eagles are becoming more and more common, you know, those nests are becoming more and more common around here.
You mentioned DDT poisoning as one of the factors that had contributed to its decline. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, DDT was a common insecticide that was used for mosquito control and other things for many, many years, and it accumulates in the environment. And eagles, peregrine falcons, things like that being top-shelf predators, it's what we call bioaccumulates within their bodies and their tissue, and it made their eggshells particularly thin so that they would not withstand the weight of the adult birds when they would go to incubate them. And so reproduction of some of those species just crashed. Osprey was another one because that particular thing would and eagles are fish eaters, you know, fish in the aquatic environment. This pesticide would wind up there and accumulate in those species, and the birds of prey would eat them. So,
but eagle endangerment dates back further than DDT, doesn't it? I mean, I doing some research for the show, I was finding statistics about eagle endangerment in the late 19th century with elimination of certain kinds of forests and draining of swamps.
Certainly habitat issues and out-and-out, you know, killing, shooting, indiscriminate shooting in some places of large predators. That was not uncommon in the early part of last century.
Illegal hunting was huge.
So how would you say that we're doing now with our eagle populations as compared with sort of a broader look at the time over history?
I would think populations in the lower 48 are approaching where they were in pre-settlement times. Of course, we don't have numbers to compare to back then, but I would think it's getting very close. It's a tremendous conservation success story. I like the fact that, you know, we get used to seeing eagles now and hopefully not take them for granted and still appreciate their beauty. But it's not an uncommon thing to see just about anywhere in our state at any time of year now. And that's
and by our state, are you talking about Missouri?
In Missouri, yeah.
What about Kansas?
In Kansas also, yeah.
Kansas a little less so just because of a little less water. But,
They'll have golden eagles out west, in western Kansas.
Where would you go if you were wanting to spot some eagles?
Always near water,
yeah.
Large lakes and rivers along the Missouri River. Now, we've had active eagle nests in recent years at both Longview and Blue Springs Lakes on the Missouri side. I was told recently the nest at Longview was not active this year for whatever reason. But so you don't have to go far to potentially see them. But anywhere along the Missouri River is not a bad bet.
That's one of the beauties, I think, of being here in the Midwest. You know, we see, you know, the birds that are moving in the wintertime, you know, during migration, spring and fall, and then we also have them nesting here, so it's a great place.
The bald eagle is not just a bird to most Americans. It's also a national symbol. How does that play into these efforts, and how does it play into people's relationships with eagle watching, do you think?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons we have the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, the federal act that protects them and has been very beneficial for them and has helped their population increase.
Well, Central Standard's spring visit with Nature in the City will return in a moment with ideas for great hiking locations in and around town. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll return shortly. Hello, I'm Gina Kaufman here with Central Standard's seasonal Nature in the City series. We're talking about spring right now, and I'd like for my guests to introduce themselves.
I'm Larry Rizzo. I'm a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation.
And I'm Joe Werner, a biologist and urban ecologist.
So we're coming up on a perennial favorite for our listeners, as well as a personal favorite of mine, walks in the woods. And I'd love to hear some suggestions about good places to go right now. Let's start close to town, Larry.
Well, I'll start with a couple of my own agency's places. Maple Woods, natural area up in Gladstone, and Baroque Woods Conservation Area in Blue Springs. Both have nice trail systems. And the places that I'm particularly selecting right now, and I think Joe, too, are places where they tend to be more forested, and these are the places where you can go see the nice wildflowers of spring, which we call the ephemeral wildflowers that bloom before the tree canopy leafs out, when they can get some sunlight. And there can be some tremendous displays around here in some of these places, but they're relatively short-lived, so you need to get out and enjoy them while you can. A couple more I could think of. One of my personal favorites is Isley Park Woods Natural Area up in Excelsior Springs. It has some of the most spectacular spring wildflower displays I've seen anywhere. Joe, help me out.
As long as we're up north, there's the Deadman Woods near Plattsburgh. It's, again, a beautiful place for spring wildflowers.
When you say spring wildflowers, first of all, what kinds of flowers specifically are you talking about? What are some of the species?
Well, there's a whole suite of them that are those ephemerals, things like Dutchman's Breeches and Bloodroot and Trout Lilies or Dogtooth Violets, another name for them. Some of the violets can be part of that, wild geraniums, phlox. There are many species, but like I say, you need to appreciate them now because most of them don't bloom too awfully long.
So when you say not too awfully long, what would you say is like the time limit on this?
Weeks.
Yeah, and you're talking about wildflowers that bloom while the sun is still hitting the forest floor. Once the leaves come out, then it pretty much shuts them down for the most part.
Another place I would be remiss not to mention, Swope Park. Swope Park has, unfortunately, I think the natural features of that park been overlooked by far too many people for far too long. And right now there's a tremendous network of trails being constructed in there by a mountain biking group. But, of course, you can hike on them too. But if you look for swopetrails.com, you can get a map of this trail system, and there's some really neat trails, and you'll see some good wildflowers there too.
Anywhere else right around town, Joe?
Well, and if you really want to learn about what you're seeing out there, you would go to the nature centers. The Lakeside Nature Center, as Laurie was just talking about, in Swope Park is just a wonderful place. At Burrock Woods, they have a nature center. The Martha Lafitte Thompson Nature Center up in Liberty. Ernie Miller over in Johnson County. There's just wonderful places to go this time of the year and really learn about things and experience nature.
What about day trip worthy trails?
You might look to some of the state parks. Mm-hmm. Weston Bend State Park in Platte County.
That's a great place for migratory birds.
A little longer drive, Haha Tonka State Park down near Lake of the Ozarks, or Truman State Park down that way. A little closer, Knob Noster State Park.
Yeah.
They have some nice trails and wildflowers there.
So you're naming a lot of places, and I could imagine someone sitting out there thinking, well, how do I decide which of these places is right for me, what I feel like doing today, my ability level, et cetera. What are some of the distinguishing characteristics that would drive you to one of these places versus another?
Well, if somebody was just beginning, I would suggest that they start at one of the nature centers. Because they have staff there that can explain things to you and let you know what's going on the trails that are associated with the nature centers. And they have literature that explain different things. So that's always a very good starting point.
What do you think, Larry?
I think that's a great idea. But it also depends, you know, look at how much time you have, how much time you want to spend driving versus hiking. How much hiking do you want to do? Some of the places I mentioned have trails that are miles long. Others are much shorter than that. So just depends on what you're up for and how much time you have.
Larry mentioned Squaw Creek earlier. That's a very nice day trip. And not only can you see the marsh there, but you can hike the Los Hills and get up very high over the marsh overlooking the Missouri River bottoms. And it's a great thing to do either early in the morning or late in the evening as the geese are coming in and out from their migration to settle in or leave.
We've talked about places, great places to walk in the woods, and that's with a particular emphasis on wildflowers. But what about nice open expanses here this spring, the Flint Hills?
Well, I tell you what, the best place, it's actually an international site of biological value, and that's, out in the Flint Hills, the there's a couple areas out there. The Cheyenne Bottoms is probably one of the best places in the Midwest to go and view migratory birds, especially the waterfowl. And The Kansas chapter of the Nature Conservancy has just been very valuable in supporting the efforts out there at Cheyenne Bottoms, helping them do some acquisitions and funding for various things. So private organizations like that can play a big part in preserving these wonderful areas.
And you can see animals out there, too, particularly bison, right?
You know,
Konza Prairie.
Yeah, at Konza Prairie.
But near Manhattan.
Yeah, near Manhattan, just off of Interstate 70. It's right on Interstate 70. That's a great place. And again, the spring wildflowers on the prairies. And closer to home, the Jerry Smith Park in Martin City is a wonderful place to see prairie restoration. Larry has been very involved with Kansas City Wildlands, another private nonprofit organization in Kansas City, to reestablish the prairie there.
And there are it's a good point. There are a lot of wildflowers to see in spring on our prairies too. The Department of Conservation publishes a thing called the Public Prairies of Missouri, which I hope is available online. I feel pretty certain to say it is, and you can look at that and find out where all the prairies are in Missouri, public prairies, and visit them. Some are close by. Some are. There's really quite a few within 2-hour drive of Kansas City.
So let's say someone's planning on heading out and taking up some of your suggestions this very weekend. What about hiking etiquette? I mean, especially if these are novices, we tend to think of the wilderness as a place with no rules. But are there do's and don'ts that you might like to share when it comes to respecting the trails and respecting fellow hikers?
Yeah, absolutely. Things like, it depends a little bit on the area, but, you know, in some places you're required to stay on the trail. If a trail has switchbacks in it, things like that, you want to stay on the trail, not shortcut those. Don't walk the trails if they're too muddy where you hurt them. Of course, you don't do things like litter, pick flowers, remove animals. You know, I'm talking about things like reptiles, for instance, or something that people might be tempted to collect and try to make pets out of.
Well, even collecting wildflowers is not a very good idea.
Wildflowers, we must remember, their job is to produce seeds, so we have more wildflowers. You pick that thing when it's in flower, it doesn't have a chance to do that.
So just love them while they're there, while you're there, and don't take
pictures.
Them home.
Yeah.
Take pictures, leave footprints.
Okay,
gentle
well,
footprints.
On that conservationist gentle footprint note, it's time for me to say goodbye to Larry Rizzo and Joe Werner. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm already looking forward to catching up with you this summer.
Thank you, Gina.
Sure.
Thanks,
you've
Gina.
Been listening to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, turning this conversation back over to Sylvia Maria Gross and the Spring Fund Drive.